Hey everyone, thanks for downloading the show. As you know, this show couldn't exist without your generous support. So if you'd like to contribute and support the show, head over to the Brains Matter website and click on one of the green donation buttons. There are a few donation options available. You can donate in US or Australian dollars, but if you have any other currency, don't worry, those will be automatically converted over. Remember, this is your show, and without your support, it wouldn't be possible. Now on to the episode. Welcome to Brains Matter, the podcast on science, curiosities, and general knowledge. I'm your host, just an ordinary guy. I'm here at the Astronomical Society of Australia conference being held at Monash University, and with me today I've got Karen Lewis from the Tokyo Institute of Technology. So welcome to the show, Karen.
Good to be here.
So Karen, could you tell us a little bit about your background and what you're researching?
I did a physics maths double degree in Perth. I did maths honours. Then I did a PhD in astrophysics, looking at the detection of moons. And since then, I've moved to the Tokyo Institute of Technology, in particular part of ELSI, which is a group looking at the origin of life in the universe. And I'm currently looking at whether or not we can detect moons of extrasolar planets.
So how are you going around trying to determine that? So
for my thesis, I was looking at moons of pulsar planets and moons of transiting planets. So pulsar planets are planets that orbit pulsars, so rotating neutron stars.
Are they very common?
They're very rare, actually. So there's, depending on how you class a planet, there's either four or five of them that have been discovered, and four of them were discovered in the 1990s, and then since then there's this fifth one, but they think that was a white dwarf, not actually a planet. So they're
so
really rare.
That's one of those things where it's a fine line between is it a planet or is it a star?
Yes. So they're quite rare, and for one of the pulsar planets you can do something. But it's sort of, you can rule out that it's not two Jupiter things spaced by like one AU orbiting each other. And that's pretty much it. So that's quite difficult, but I did that. Currently, I'm working on moons of transiting planets, so planets that pass in front of the face of their parent star viewed from the Earth. And this is more promising because moons cause extra perturbations on the transit light curve, and so that's what I'm currently doing.
So how great are these perturbations? Because if you think about it, a star is a massive big object. Then you have a planet going past it, so it would have a slight wobble effect or slight Doppler shift effect, depending on which technique you use. But a moon around a planet around the star, that would seem extremely tiny to me. So how easy or difficult is that to detect?
It depends on the size of the moon. So for the transit technique, the detectability of planets goes as, because it's a planet physically blocking the star, so the amount of light blocked is proportional to the area of the planet, so it's the radius squared. So for moons, it's the same thing. If you have a big moon, it's really detectable. If you have a small moon, it's not. Also, if your moon is orbiting your planet, maybe the planetary transit is early or late, because the moon can shift where the planet is. And so if you have a really massive moon, you get a big signal. If you have a really light moon, you get a small signal.
So what have you been doing your research lately specifically?
So the thing that I've been doing specifically, the technique is called scattering the folded light curve. So you take a set of planetary transits and you stack them on top of each other. And so the perturbation...
Are these different planets or...
The same planet.
The same planet over different time.
Yes, so transit one, transit two, transit three. So what's one of the ones I'm doing, the orbital period's like 200 days. And so... the first one, and then you wait 200 days, you take the second one, and you stick it on top, etc. And so the extra perturbations due to the moon, they're somewhere near the planetary transit, because moons have to be close to their host planet. Mm-hmm. And so they're different for each transit, and so close to the planetary transit you get, they don't match up.
So the way we can think about that is with our revolution around the sun. So the Earth's revolving around the sun takes 365 days, the moon takes
28
days and the little bit extra. And at any point in time, there's the combination of that 28 days plus the 365 days. So for someone who's sitting at a fixed point in space outside, when the Earth passes in front of them, the moon may be in a different position, and that's the technique you're using.
Yeah, that's the sort of general idea. And so the more transits you have, the better. So I'm currently investigating that. That's the current investigation. And that's what I'm presenting as well.
And so you've said in the 90s they found four, maybe five.
Of pulsar planets.
For pulsar planets. How about for normal extrasolar planets? What kind of numbers are we looking at that we know of so far?
Oh dear. I think it's something like 700 that they know. But so Kepler, which is a telescope in space looking for transiting planets now, it's got 1,000, 2,000 candidates. And so they're things like, most of them have a fairly good probability of being actual planets, but because they're so far away, it's very difficult to tell. So the problem is, if you have a small star going in front of a large star, you can get a transit signal that looks very like a planet. And unless you have like spectral information, unless there's multiple planets, unless there's all these different things, it's difficult to tell it apart.
So binary systems could provide a false positive effectively.
Yes, there's papers on this. I'm trying to remember the numbers. I think if there's multiple candidates in a system, it's quite likely that they're all planets. If it's single, it's less likely. But I can't remember the numbers. It's like 30% false positive or 50% false positive, but I can't remember the numbers.
And so how many of these do we suppose have moons around those exoplanets?
That is quite difficult. So if you look in our solar system, the gas giant planets, all of them have families of moons. Earth has a large moon, and it's thought that it's due to a giant impact. And according to simulations, giant impacts that are capable of forming something like our moon are apparently common. So from our solar system, it would be expected that there would be moons, assuming all the same physics applies. However, like whether or not they're detectable is a different story. So in our solar system, the gas giant planets, there's reasons, theoretical reasons, to think that there's an upper mass limit on those moons. And so it's detecting moons under that mass limit is quite difficult. So
because they're so small and so far away.
Yes. So if there's large moons, yes, we can detect them. If there's small moons, it's going to get pretty hard.
And this comes back to the search for extrasolar planets as well, because the hot Jupiters were the ones that we all found initially because they were so big, and some of them, you know, many multiples the size of our own Jupiter. But if you know, everyone keeps asking the question, can we find an Earth-like planet out there? We can't actually find something the size of a single Earth, can we? It's twice the size of the Earth, which is the minimum limit at the moment for Kepler, or something around that number.
They haven't found Earth in the habitable zone yet. They found a Mercury somewhere.
Okay.
I can't remember where they found it, but they found this Mercury-sized thing. They're getting smaller, but I'll leave it in the hands of the Kepler team, because they've got, like, they have groups. So it's like, we're gonna find habitable planets groups, there's the we're going to look at star spots groups, there's they can deal with that. I'll deal with my stuff, they deal with their stuff.
But. So it still seems amazing to me that given the difficulty of finding smaller planets that we can detect these moons. I understand the technique we're using, but it still seems quite amazing.
Yes, it's when I started, I think people thought it was a little bit strange because like Koro hadn't been launched, Kepler hadn't been launched, all the surveys were pretty much ground-based surveys. There was some HST data, that's really nice, but it was, and now there's like Kepler data, you can download the data, you can play with the data on your computer. I think you can download the Koro data as well, but I haven't done that yet, so I've just been doing Kepler things. So I think, and there's more people in the field. Like when I started, there was like me and maybe like four other people, and now there's, I don't know, 20, 30, I don't know how many people, but there's lots of people. So
what happens in the situation where you've got an extrasolar planet with multiple moons? Does that make it more difficult to detect? How does that change the perturbations?
So it depends which ones you're looking at. For the technique I'm looking at, I think it might make it slightly easier because the bumps all change.
But does that just mean it's easy to detect that there's something there but you can't tell how many?
It's a bit of a problem. Like if you've got the transit timing one, you need more transits because there's more sinusoids. So yeah, I think, and it depends what they're doing. So if you've got sinusoids, maybe they add together, maybe they subtract away. I'm currently unaware of any work looking at multiple moon systems. Like I assume one moon, there's someone who's published a lot, David Kipping, he assumes one moon generally. I haven't seen any work of his where he assumes more than one moon, because one moon is hard enough. But yeah, so like the Jupiter system, Saturn systems, they're multiple.
Because the reason I ask that is if we look at our solar system, the more common is multiple.
Yes. I mean, in Saturn system, you have Titan, and so Titan would dwarf the signals from anything else. But in Jupiter system, you have like four big whopping moons.
What's next in what's your next steps in your research? Where to from here?
So I'm currently finishing up the work on the scatter in the folded light curve stuff. There's some other people in Tokyo Institute of Technology, and they're looking at different ways of moon formation. And so one option is to compare my results with their results. I think that's where the interesting things lie. So for example, some of the people at Tokyo Institute of Technology, they do moon formation, and so they have limits. And so if we can compare my limits to their limits, then it supports their formation model. I think that's what I'd like to do. That's what I'm really excited about.
Well, best of luck with that, Karen Lewis. Thank you for joining us today. Thanks for listening to the show. You can check out the Brains Matter website at www.brainsmatter.com. That's www.brainsmatter.com. And you can find all the other episodes of the show there. Just click on the podcast link on the right hand side. There's also other information on the site, such as subscription details, both via iTunes and manually. If you want to support the show, have a look at the Support the Show link. You can make a donation via PayPal. If you have any comments or suggestions, you can leave an entry on this episode's show notes on the webpage, or you can send me an email.
All my contact information can be found on the site. The theme music Future is performed by Cut Copy and comes courtesy of Glenn Gertz from Modular Records. I hope you enjoyed the show. Bye for now. We'll be right back.